I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. Back in the fall, a majority of the editorial board of the Neshaminy High School newspaper voted to stop using the word Redskin or Skins in its publication. Redskin happens to be the name of the school's football team, its mascot, and is a school nickname. Writing in the paper, The Playwickian, their editorial said the word was offensive, racist, and a term of hate. The administration overturned the ban, and now the case looks like it's headed to the courts. The students have legal representation and believe their constitutional rights are being violated. We'll begin our conversation during this hour with Jillian McGoldrick. She's a junior at Neshaminy, editor-in-chief of The Playwickian. And Jillian McGoldrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, just calm down. You're doing just fine. Let me add to our listeners that we did invite Neshaminy High School Principal Rob McKee to join our conversation, and he did decline that invitation to join us. Jillian, let me go back to you and go back to the fall. Was there an event at Neshaminy or even in the editorial board that got you thinking about this issue, this word, Redskin?
A parent within our district actually filed a complaint with our district that because she is Native American and she felt that the term was racist, and she got very emotional about it. And once we really saw how much it affected her, and we started to research for ourselves and saw how many people this word hurts, that was when we all decided that it was time for us to take a stand.
Well, and I should say that not everyone on the editorial board agreed with this ban. Is that correct?
Yes. We have 21 editors on the editorial board, and 14 sided with the majority, and 7 sided with the
minority.
Yeah, minority. Thanks.
And was it a vigorous debate in your editorial board?
Yes, it really was. It was a very back and forth. People changed their minds. I personally changed my mind many times going back and forth, seeing both sides of this. And then we all decided once we took our vote what we were going to do.
It's complicated because it's a nickname for the school. It's the mascot. It's on T-shirts. It's on uniforms. It's a word that is so woven into the fabric of the high school. Do you have a workaround word that you're going to use?
We can just say the team. So it'll be like Neshaminy football, Neshaminy soccer, Neshaminy. We don't necessarily need to use this racist term in our writing.
I know the principal disagrees with you, and one of the concerns that he has is that by banning this word in your newspaper, you're preventing other students who want to use this word and perhaps don't see it as racist or hateful or insensitive.
Yes, but at the same time, we have our right to edit, as editors do. So we have the right to change it to Neshaminy football, Neshaminy, because that's what the Constitution says.
Has this been I know this started in the fall. Is this still a pretty vigorous debate at Neshaminy?
Not so much. It sort of has calmed down, but it's not something that's going to go away.
And that's because lawyers are getting involved?
Yes, yes.
I'm interested in whether you've had conversations with the principal or members of the administration, if you've had a chance to sit down with them and talk about your decision.
Yes, in November we had a meeting with our principal and one of the vice principals, and we all sat down with our parents, all of the editors came, and them, and they gave us their side of it, and then we also gave our side of what we see. And at the end of the meeting, there really wasn't a conclusion because we obviously are still fighting this, but it was good to see where they were coming from and be able to explain ourselves.
Are you surprised about the amount of attention your decision has generated over the last few months?
Yes, for sure. Nobody expected this. We were just taking out a word. We didn't think it was going to become such a huge deal.
I noticed the Bucks County Courier-Times has also decided not to use the word Redskin. Do you think in any ways they're taking a page from you?
Yes, actually, they in their editorial that they wrote, they actually defended our decision and said that we have the right to do this and that they, too, are going to do it.
Do you want to be a journalist when you get through college and out into the world?
I've tried to talk myself out of it many times, but I can't get away from it.
And why is that? I'm just curious, Jillian.
Oh, just because it's not exactly the most high-paying job or well-paying job at all, but I think it would be something that I have to go into.
Well, you know, I noticed that you received an award from Widener University. It's a leadership award. I'm looking at a piece that was posted, it looks like the Bucks County Courier-Times, saying that one of the people that recommended you or supported your nomination is your principal.
Yes, and that was so cool that he did that and he helped nominate me.
So this issue continues. Do you know when this might end up in the courts or what the next step is for the editorial board at Neshaminy?
Well, for right now, we don't exactly have anything that's happening currently. We had a letter of advocacy from our attorneys that just went out to the administration, and that was the last thing that's happened, but in no way do we want to be suing our district at all. That is not the goal here. We just want to be able to use our policy and put it in practice without any interference.
And final question to you, Jillian, what have you learned from this incident?
I've learned so much. I've learned about law. I've learned about Native American culture. I've learned so much. It's amazing.
Well, I appreciate your enthusiasm, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times and getting us started. And that's Jillian McGoldrick. She's editor-in-chief of the Playwickian. That's a Neshaminy High School student newspaper. She's a junior at Neshaminy and the first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times as we take a look at this issue that began in a Bucks County high school and has generated a lot of attention across the country. And joining us now is Frank Lamonte. He's the executive director of the Student Press Law Center. I should add that he was a journalist before going to law school and before ending up at the Student Press Law Center. And Frank Lamonte, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
Are you surprised that this issue, which began a couple of months ago, but has such national legs?
Yeah, it really is quite rare that you find an issue involving student journalism that catches the public's imagination this way and takes on so much salience. But I think you alluded to one of the factors yourself, which is that the professional news media around the country is wrestling with this very same issue, where you've got terms that seem outdated and antiquated and offensive to certain groups. Is it time to just dispense with them? Here where I am in Washington, D.C., we wrestle with this in the pages of the Washington Post on a daily basis. Will the Redskins of Washington still be the Redskins of Washington? The owner is being called upon to change the name and is resisting doing so. So, yeah, I think they sort of caught a wave of national salience here, and they're showing leadership. They're actually inspiring people in the profession to step up to the line and take a stand themselves.
Well, and what makes it interesting and probably even more complicated is we're talking about a student newspaper. Do students have the same First Amendment rights as adults?
They certainly don't during school and on school grounds and when they're using school property. The courts have struggled to get the exact boundaries right here, but there's a pretty broad agreement that students have a limited degree of First Amendment protection when they're on school property during school time, not the same that you and I would have walking down the street or in a public park on the sidewalk, but First Amendment rights nonetheless that can't be taken away by a public school. The public school is a government actor.
Right.
It's a part of the state just like the police are or just like prison guards or any other government employees, and they are bound both by the First Amendment and in Pennsylvania by a very strong Pennsylvania statute, which was enacted by the State Board of Education and then ratified by your state legislature in 2005, which pretty conclusively settles this controversy. The Board of Ed and the legislature decided where to draw the line in Pennsylvania, and they took a very balanced, common-sense approach where they said, if the students are getting ready to do something that actually breaks the law or incites other people to break the law or makes it harder for the school to be able to do business, then the school administration can step in. Otherwise, the students get to choose the content of their choice.
I'm looking actually at a letter, or it looks like an email, that the principal sent to the advisor, I guess faculty advisor, to the Play Wiki, and he had some interesting questions. This goes back a month or so. Is the Play Wikian's intention to restrict or censor all editors and potential staff writers of future Play Wikian articles from using the name of the high school monikers? Is the Play Wikian's intention to restrict or censor all photos of students wearing references to these monikers? Are these legitimate questions, you think?
Well, they're interesting questions, but I think it really goes to the bigger picture about why school principals don't need to be in the business of editing newspapers, because they really don't understand how newspapers work. And that's completely, completely excusable. Being a principal is a really hard job. You've got to run everything from transportation to safety to curriculum to health, all of these things that you have to have a little bit of expertise in, but neither principals nor their lawyers are trained in media law and First Amendment law, and it really shows the limitations of their knowledge when they're saying things like, are you trying to bind all future writers and editors of the Play Wiki in forever? Well, of course that's not the way newspapers work. Whenever a new round of editors comes into a newsroom, they get to make stylistic decisions about, you know, what things are we going to capitalize and what abbreviations are we going to use? What nicknames are we going to use? All these types of style decisions are made by editors in professional newsrooms, in college newsrooms, and in high school newsrooms around the country. And that's how you learn as a high school journalist. You learn by taking responsibility for making these decisions yourself, not by having them imposed on you by authority figures.
Well, and there were, as Jillian told us, some members of the editorial board that didn't agree with this decision. And I'm just looking at a sentence here that they also wrote in an editorial, Neshaminy illustrates a genuine example of how in present day the attached defamation has integrated. The idea that over time, and perhaps in use in a much more benign way, the word redskin doesn't have those same kind of connotations.
Sure, and that's a perfectly legitimate difference of opinion to have, and it's wonderful that the student editors did the exact right professional thing on their own, not being forced to do so, by letting there be a robust, open point-counterpoint discussion in the pages of the newspaper. But just like any newspaper, at some point, the editor just has to say, this is our style, these are our conventions, these are the names that we are going to use, and every writer who wishes to work for the publication has to adhere to that. The buck has to stop somewhere, and Pennsylvania law and the First Amendment say that the buck stops with the student editor. It's very different to say, I've heard the school say, well, we're afraid that the editors are engaging in censorship. The editor isn't a state government official. The principal is a state government official. The First Amendment acts as a constraint on government dictating what you can and can't believe and what you can and can't say, not on what teenager decides to edit into another story.
Frank, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I also want to open up the lines for any questions or comments. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about the Neshaminy Redskin controversy, the rights of student newspapers, and Frank Lamonti is our guest, executive director of the Student Press Law Center. Much more after this very short break. Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA Continuing Education invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels this spring with a lineup of drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking classes, weekend workshops, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and master classes with noted artists. Registration is now open, and classes begin January 21st. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
Next time in Studio 360, Ben Stiller isn't a daredevil, but that's really him skateboarding down a mountain in his new movie.
But then I was basically pulled up off the skateboard and I was like dangling from this arm like a marionette going 40 miles
an hour. I want to see those scenes.
I have them. They're going to be on the DVD and the outtakes.
Ben Stiller and the Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now. Thousands of protesters in Thailand jammed the streets in the capital of Bangkok. They want to oust the current government and replace it with an unelected People's Council. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Just a recap. Last fall, the editors of the Neshaminy High School student newspaper, The Playwickian, said they would no longer use the word redskin or skins in their publication. Now, redskin is Neshaminy's longtime nickname, the name of its mascots, its sports teams. We began our conversation with Jillian McGoldrick, editor and chief of The Playwickian. And again, Frank Lamonti, the executive director of the Student Press Law Center, is with us. And if you have any questions or comments about this very interesting controversy, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Frank, the Supreme Court has even looked into this issue. What are some of the important, I guess, or what the important decision that the Supreme Court has made about student newspapers that would apply to Neshaminy?
Sure. So the starting point for all student First Amendment questions is the Tinker case. That's the landmark case back in 1969 that we all learn about in our middle school civics class. That's the case in which the students wore anti-war armbands to school and were punished for doing so. And the Supreme Court, in this very resounding vindication of student First Amendment rights, said, no, students do not check their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gate. And they drew the line in a very common sense, middle-of-the-road fashion, where they said the school may step in at the point where the speech is either illegal or is substantially disruptive of the school. Well, that was the law for 20 years. Then the Supreme Court came back at a case called the Hazelwood case in 1988, a case that just turned 25 years old, and the Supreme Court said in that case, well, when you're using a curricular vehicle of the school for expression, in that case it was a newspaper, but it could be a play, it could be a graduation speech, when you're using a part of the school curriculum to make your speech, then the school has more control. They have more control over the use of public property, government property, than your own personal property, the words coming out of your mouth or the words on your T-shirt or the apparel that you choose to wear. And that's been the law for 25 years, but there have been a wave of states, Pennsylvania included, that recognized that Hazelwood really threw that balance out of whack and has given way too much censorship authority to schools, which unfortunately they tend to used sometimes in mischievous ways, and so many states have gone back by regulation or statute and have restored the balance to the Tinker days, which again is not a students run wild, anything right. goes standard. It is a standard that recognizes both the interest in free expression, but also the interest in keeping order and making sure that the school runs smoothly.
Do they have a description or example of what disruption would look like if it were, you know, if something goes too far, what that would look like?
Sure. I mean, over the years, the lower courts have told us that disruption are things like if you're going to provoke violence, you know, you're going to, this comes up all the time in things like gang apparel or Confederate flag apparel. If you're actually going to incite a violent reaction by your speech, then you can be forced to change the shirt or to remove the armband or to otherwise change the message if it is going to actually ignite violence or it is going to incite people, let's say, to get up and walk out of class. But if it's just going to provoke discussion, if it's just going to provoke difference of opinion and conversation, guess what? That's how you learn civics. You know, that is part of the educational experience, is to have lively back and forth debates about public issues. And honestly, what we're seeing playing out in Neshaminy is a terrific civics lesson.
Well, and even looking at the back and forth, I guess, letters to the editor, responses from students reflecting many different opinions about this decision.
And that's the wonderful thing, is that student media provides that vehicle for people to engage. You know, schools so often give lip service and talk about how they want young people to be civically engaged. And they're comfortable with it as long as the young people are talking about famine in Darfur or something that's thousands of miles away. Mm-hmm. But as soon as young people try to engage on issues of public concern to improve their own school, then our administrators often get nervous. The best ones recognize, and there are many really good ones, the best one recognize that you have to give a little control, you have to give up a little control in order for people to have the best quality learning experience. And there's no doubt that what Jillian and the students are going through at Neshaminy is a really excellent learning experience from which they'll benefit for the rest of their lives.
Do you have sympathy for the principal or even administrators? Because I'm sure they're caught between these members of the editorial board and the school board and alumni and other members of the probably the faculty and the student body.
Sure. I think it's a tough decision, and I respect the difficult job that school administrators have. On the other hand, when you have a state law that so clearly addresses itself to this very type of situation, I think really the legislature and the Board of Ed have taken the administrators off the hook. They've given them a really convenient out to be able to say, look, guys, I understand where you're coming from. I empathize with you. I like to say go Redskins. I've got a closet full of Redskins sweatshirts, but the law has made this decision for me, and I must obey the law.
I'm curious if there's, let's say, one of the teams wins, and I'm sure they win all the time. Let's say there's a photo, and there are people in shirts that say Redskins. Is a student newspaper allowed to sort of cover up those words, or does this raise some questions about how to actually institute this policy?
Sure. And that's, again, that's a judgment that's best made on a case-by-case basis by the people in the newsroom. What does it really mean to say we're going to restrict the word from the paper? Maybe if it shows up incidentally in a T-shirt, you decide that's different from the editors actually having to sign their name to a story that they disapprove of. That would violate what the Supreme Court has recognized as a compelled speech, right? Putting the words in the mouths of people who don't want to subscribe to them. But maybe, the T-shirt or the sweatshirt or the ball cap and a photo is different. But what's great is that's not my decision to make. That's the student editor's decision to make on a case-by-case basis, and the law gives them that right.
This editorial board has a faculty advisors. I'm assuming most school newspapers, or probably all school newspapers, have. Does that put that person in a peculiar position because they're there to advise the students, but they're also a member of the faculty and the administration?
Being a faculty advisor is an incredibly tough job, and I have the utmost respect for people who agree to do it because, right, it really does make you walk a tightrope each and every day between your respect for the students' voices and your loyalty as an obedient public servant working for a school administration. The best faculty advisors, and the country is full of them, recognize that the word advisor means to advise. It doesn't mean to decide. Now, if they see that the students are about to go way, way wrong, they're about to violate copyright laws, they're about to publish something defamatory, then by all means, they have the ability to put their foot on the brake, and the law recognizes that. But short of a decision like that that's actually going to cause legal liability or is going to inflict harm on others, then just a judgment call over taste and style is really one that is for the students to make. After all, it is their names on the paper, and it is they who are supposed to be getting the learning experience out of this. It doesn't really teach kids anything for the principal to kill a story, right? You don't learn writing by not being allowed to write. You don't learn editing by not being allowed to edit.
And we are talking about a very interesting controversy involving Neshaminy High School, which is in Bucks County, just outside of Philadelphia, and a decision by the school's student newspaper to no longer use the word Redskin or Skins in its publication. We're curious about where you stand on this particular issue, the rights of student newspapers. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And again, Frank Lamonti is our guest, executive director of the Student Press Law Center. He was an award-winning investigative journalist before going to law school and before ending up as director at the center. There was, an attempt in the fall to put an ad in the Play Wiki and that said Redskins, a tradition for almost a century. Now, if we're talking about an outside organization putting an ad in the newspaper, do the students have control over that as well?
They really do. The Supreme Court has said that advertising content is still a part of the editorial product. And so just as the editor-in-chief ultimately has to make the run-don't-run call about the photos and the headlines and the captions and the stories, that person still, at the end of the day, has to make the run-don't-run call over the advertisements. Mm-hmm. You know, people may make judgments differently there, and now we're getting into sort of ethical decision-making rather than legal decision-making. And again, one of the great benefits of journalism is it teaches you how to make ethical decisions, which will serve you well for the rest of your life, but you may make the ethical decision that, hey, that advertiser's speech is not my speech. People are not going to attribute that to me or believe that I agree with it as the editor, and so I'll go ahead and let it run. And I think that would have been a totally defensible judgment call on their part. As it turns out, the person who was going to place the ad, I think, recognized that he was maybe being a little in your face and was going to inflame the situation more, and I think pretty wisely made the judgment to withdraw that and not to inflame the controversy, so the decision never had to get made.
But could the principal, obviously depending on how the courts decide, assuming this goes to the courts, could the principal, or maybe even the meantime, while it's in process, could he force them to use this word, Redskin?
Well, that's where a possible court challenge could get teed up. I mean, where we're sitting right now is really in a little bit of a limbo state. Until someone actually submits an ad or a column and wishes to use that word, then we really don't have a live legal controversy, because we have an order that's not being executed. We have a policy that's not being carried out. The moment that the students are told, I don't care what you want, I am ordering you to publish that column, or I am ordering you to accept that advertisement, that is when you tee up a potential legal controversy. And as Jillian, the editor, told you, no one wants to take a school to court. I just grieve over that. That is a loss for everyone, because it's wasted time, it's wasted money, and it puts the students in an adversarial position with a school that they love, that they are loyal to, and want to be loyal alumni of. And so that's a real loss. You know, I think this discretion will take over here, I predict. It almost always does. These cases almost never have to go to court, because when the law is as clear as it is here, normally cooler and wiser heads prevail.
We have an email from Jeff. Is there universal acceptance that Redskin is as a team nickname is offensive? Can it be noble like Spartan? And, of course, this gets into this linguistic debate about words like Redskin, even words like queer. There are other words as well.
Sure, yeah, and, you know, having followed this discussion at the Washington Redskins level, right, you know, Mr. Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins, will tell you that he has support from some Native American individuals and organizations who will say, we regard this as being an honor to us. On the other hand, you know, I think there's substantial public opinion otherwise, that it's not, you know, I'm not a historian of this, it's not my area of expertise. I will say that we just had a ruling from the federal government. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office just decided last week that they wouldn't grant somebody a trademark on the name Redskins for use in a commercial product, because the federal government, recognized the term Redskins as being a derogatory racial term. So I think the consensus is building generally that it is a taboo word that ought not to be adopted by our schools as a symbol.
But what you're also saying is that school newspapers like the Playwickian, they have the editorial right to make a decision about this word.
They certainly have the editorial right to make the decision to subscribe or not to subscribe to its use. And let's be clear, right? The editors are not saying don't wear it on your uniforms. They're not saying don't buy the T-shirts or the hats. You can go and cheer Go Redskins all you want on Friday nights, but what you can't do is write it in the newspaper underneath their names. As long as they are the editors, they wish to take this principled stand, which they have arrived at after very careful, open deliberation. And it's their right to do that.
Let me see what looks like Roberta from Chestnut Hill has to say. Roberta, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
There are, in my view, two great wrongs and tragedy in the history of our country, and one has to do with African Americans and one has to do with Native Americans, two groups we have badly abused. No one now would consider it a matter of choice to use the N-word. And I expect one day, and I hope soon, it will not be considered a matter of choice to use the word Redskins. Thank you.
Roberta, thank you for calling into Radio Times. Anything you want to add to that, Frank?
Well, I think that that's an observation that's really consistent with the direction that that the country seems to be going. Again, you've got the Federal Trade Commission Federal Trademark Office ruling. You've got many professional newspapers and media outlets forsaking this name. It really does seem that there's a growing and building consensus in that direction.
Is this an unusual case when it comes to school newspapers? I mean, is this dealing with sort of a non-typical issue?
Well, it is and it isn't. I would have to say at the Student Press Law Center, we have for 40 years maintained a legal hotline where young people can call in and talk to an attorney about their problems. And we get in the neighborhood of 2,000 cases a year called into that hotline. And when a student calls from a high school, it is often about the censorship of their views. Many people support the idea that a school ought to be allowed to censor to protect safety and to keep good order. But I will tell you that from those 40 years of experience, that's not the way censorship authority is being used. When a student calls our hotline, it is almost always because the school is engaging in image protection. Over and over again, you hear the same word. We were told that we can't make the school look bad. We were told that we can't make the school look bad. Well, you know, I hope everyone will just take a step back and think about what that means. You have a government agency telling its citizens that they are not allowed to criticize or to express dissatisfaction with the service they're receiving from a government agency. I hesitate to use the term anti-American, but I'm not sure it doesn't apply there. We just don't do business that way in America. We don't let government agencies tell us that it's we're not allowed to criticize them.
Well, and we're talking about a public school here. If this were a private school, would we be having a very different conversation, Frank?
Very much so, because the First Amendment only protects you against the actions of government agencies. There's only one state, that is California, that has statutorily decided that students in private schools have a degree of free expression protection under the laws of the state. That's a choice that each state may make, but most states have elected not to.
But about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye here, but it seems like the Neshaminy issue is really about policy. It's not about criticizing the school. It's really about a policy of a student newspaper.
Right. Well, many of these decisions really, at the end of the day, come down to empowerment or disempowerment. It comes down to, are we going to make journalism an empowering experience for young people? You know, many of the people who go into student journalism go into it because they're not the quarterback of the football team. They're not the queen of homecoming. They're people who, frankly, you know, are sometimes the marginalized, have-not geeky kids in the school, and they need this experience in order to come away from school feeling like they've had an empowered educational experience. And it really deprives them of the value that journalism can convey if they are disempowered and told that their opinions don't matter.
Well, Frank Lamonte, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the executive director of the Student Press Law Center and was an award-winning investigative journalist before going to law school and before going to the center. We began our conversation with Jillian McGoldrick, editor-in-chief of the Playwickian, and that's the Neshaminy High School student newspaper. We're going to take a very short break and then change gears slightly. We'll be talking about free speech on college campuses. And Greg Lukianoff is our guest. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive DBA.
Computer hackers recently stole the information of more than a third of all Americans from retail giant Target. On the next Fresh Air, we talk personal and global cybersecurity with P.W. Singer. His new book is called Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new album, High Hopes. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The genius of established big companies breeding the next innovators?
Corporate innovation is when you think really big about a problem that's adjacent to your space. Address that problem in a way that's good for the customers and good for yourself.
Entrepreneur Chunka Moy believes the old big Fortune 500 may be the source of the next big thing in business. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Well, from the high school campus to the college campus. And joining us now is Greg Lukianoff. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE. He's been with FIRE since 2001 when he was hired to be the organization's first director of legal and public advocacy. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. And Greg Lukianoff, nice to have you with us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What's the mission of FIRE?
FIRE's mission is primarily to defend free speech and basic rights on America's college campuses.
And would you say that we've been spending most of the hour talking about free speech rights on high school campuses? Are there different guidelines for a college campus? And perhaps even putting the question another way, does a 19-year-old on a college campus have the same rights as you and I do when we're not on a college campus?
Well, actually, the theory is that it's supposed to be, you're supposed to have the greatest free speech rights on college. So even as bad as cases we see on high school, of censorship can be, we end up with...
Very busy there at FIRE, I have to say, Greg. Don't answer that phone, though.
Yep. So you're supposed to have greater free speech rights on college campuses. And I came from a background of working working for the ACLU, of specializing in First Amendment law at Stanford. And I was just shocked at the kind of stuff that can get you in trouble on the modern college campus.
Well, help us understand, even maybe going back to last year, to 2013, what kinds of threats has FIRE seen on college campuses?
Well, this past year was pretty interesting. It seemed to be a major theme of the year was that it's risky to talk about sex on college campuses. And I've seen this in case after case, starting at a case that kind of came to a head at Appalachian State University, where a professor ran showed a video about that was critical of the pornography industry, and she was, because some students were offended, she was found guilty of harassment, and they still haven't overturned the professor's finding of harassment at App State. And there was a very similar case that just resolved only a couple days ago at University of Colorado at Boulder, involving Professor Patty Adler, where she had, for 20 years, she had a skit that involved prostitution around the world, and she'd been doing this for a long time, but the university recently, they brought her up on charges of harassment and tried to get her to retire, and it was only through the combined effort of FIRE, the ACLU, and the National Coalition Against Censorship that we, helped save her job.
But is this something new? As you said, it's risky to talk about sex on a college campus. Is this a new phenomenon?
It's definitely, it's a theme that I've observed for a long time. I call it sort of the new Victorians theme, like in the sense that a lot of times the people who think they're sort of the most progressive about sex get very anxious about it if you're talking about it, particularly with regards to liability. So the Department of Education and the Department of Justice have rules that regard harassment. And unfortunately, earlier this year, they passed some new guidelines that were so broad and so vague that you can kind of understand why universities are increasingly paranoid about people having sexually frank conversations on campuses.
Help us understand how the government framed that.
Sure, yeah. It was really bizarre because for a long time, the government had actually been fairly helpful to try to limit the scope of harassment codes, to go to with constitutional standards that were unprotected speech, to say that, you know, harassment can be stopped if it's severe, persistent, and pervasive, you know, consistent First Amendment standards. But this spring, they came out with a standard that just defined harassment as any unwelcome verbal conduct, also known as speech, of a sexual nature, and they even explicitly got rid of the reasonable person standard, basically saying that if someone says something sexually related that even an unreasonable person would find offensive, that that's harassment.
Mm. So the idea that if I find something offensive, then it is offensive.
Yeah, and it's amazing because it's a standard that has been specifically addressed by the courts over and over again. It doesn't pass the laugh test. You can't actually make my speech contingent on whether or not the most easily offended person in the room is offended.
But is that where it stands today?
We managed to get the Department of Education and Justice to back down substantially, but they still haven't corrected that letter of guidance to every university in the country, because this came out in the form of a letter of guidance to University of Montana, and what the Department of Education needs to do now is they need to write a new letter of clarification and explain that the standard is actually the one that the Supreme Court laid out, not this incredibly broad, laughably unconstitutional standard they announced in the spring.
So you would say go back to severe, persistent, and pervasive?
Yeah, because when you go to the standard recommended by the Supreme Court, or in a case called Davis, you're not really talking about just speech being offensive. You're talking about a pattern of discriminatory behavior that really kind of better fits what we normally think of when we talk about harassment.
And that's Greg Lukianoff. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which happens to be located here in Philadelphia. And we began our conversation in this hour talking about an interesting case involving a high school newspaper in Bucks County, just outside of Philadelphia. We asked Greg to join us to help us understand what might be happening on college campuses related to issues of free speech, the First Amendment. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@WHYY.org or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Greg, it doesn't surprise me that there would be conflicts on a college campus about speech, because you have, you know, all these people that are convening in one place. They don't necessarily know each other. They come to a campus with different beliefs, different attitudes, different experiences, and then have to try to figure out how to sort out how to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, but I think the problem happened going back to the 70s and 80s. You have the free speech movement in the 60s and 70s, and it was very successful. But I think what ended up happening in the 80s was an idea that administrators, rather than let students interact and for better or for worse, let students figure out how they're going to get along, they started passing sort of the latest version of campus speech codes in the 1980s, which was more or less sending up a white flag, saying we're not trusting students to get along with each other, to actually get to know each other on their own. We want to make sure that they know that they shouldn't say things that offend each other. And this is, in my opinion, sort of wrong-headed, and I think it's part of a general misunderstanding of why free speech is important. Free speech is especially important to know the bad things about the reality you live in, to know that people have strange or wrong or differing opinions on things. And I think that we've unfortunately cultivated an idea that people have a right not to hear things they dislike, and that's just not intellectually healthy.
But if, let's say, someone is calling someone else, an N-word, I hate almost saying that on the air, but nonetheless, the N-word at a college campus, should that speech be controlled? Should they be allowed to say that? Some kind of interaction as a result of them saying that?
Well, that racial epithets are protected speech, and they should be. And this is part of what I mean by, but generally when people, talk about these kind of scenarios, they usually involve behavior that is, severe enough and persistent enough to be harassment. A lot of times it involves vandalism or other things that are illegal. But someone actually using a racial epithet, it is and should be protected. But what's most interesting about that is that people bring up the scenario of someone, hurling epithets or chasing someone down. When the cases I deal with on college campuses, it's reached the point where people are getting in trouble for much, much milder speech.
And do most do most college university campuses have some kind of speech code? Have you found that?
Of the 409 about colleges that we survey, and our the survey we're just about to come out with, about 59% of them maintain what we call red light speech codes, which means that they do not live up to that they're laughably unconstitutional, do not live up to First Amendment standards.
And I'm assuming it's racist or homophobic or sexist, all of that?
You know, not always. It's interesting, the sort of the diversity of codes. But, you know, one at Virginia State University that we called our speech code of the month for December, you know, just made it so vague that it says that students may not, quote, offend a member of the campus community, period. They're not more specific than that.
Let me see what Neil from Bucks County has to say. Neil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I was interested. Your conversation is focused on what goes on college campuses. And I was wondering, since you have a high school student from Neshaminy, what the guest opinion would be of how the same kind of intimidation is used by administrators, pretty much because they're worried about liability exposure in the high schools in order to rein in teachers who are more creative, let's say.
Well, you know, Neil, it's a little bit off topic, and I don't think, first of all, I don't believe the principal is intimidating the editorial board of the PlayWiki, and they have a difference of opinion, but there's no evidence that they are intimidating them in any way. But I don't know, Greg, with how much time you spend talking about or thinking about a high school campus, which is how we began our conversation today.
Definitely. I open up my book, Unlearning Liberty, talking about high school and talking about how easy it is to get in trouble for being critical of the administration these days in high school, and how much censorship you have in high school newspapers. And I think one of the points that the caller had is a very important one, to understand how much fear of liability, and to some degree exaggerated and sometimes unreasonable liability, but in some cases, you know, somewhat realistic. It's made university general counsels and high school principals alike err on the side of censoring, err on the side of, like, let's make sure that rather than say something offensive, we don't say anything at all. And that's really harmful to the environment for open discourse.
So I'm curious, and what do you think about the editorial board of the Neshaminy High School newspaper deciding to ban a word, the word redskin?
Yeah, it's interesting because when we deal with college newspapers, we treat them in theory exactly like real independent newspapers out in the real world. So a college newspaper or a high school newspaper, in our opinion, would have the right to do that. They also would likely receive an awful lot of criticism for doing that, and that's the give and take of freedom of speech.
Let me see what it looks like. Casey from Bensalem has to say. Casey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, Casey. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about conservative speech on college campuses. Long story short, about 10 years ago when I was going to college at Kent State University in Ohio, the university president actually asked the college Republicans to not sponsor a well-established conservative journalist from coming to campus because he was a conservative. And this was just a couple of months after a very liberal filmmaker was brought to campus by the college Democrats. And I just see time after time after time situations like that where conservatives are essentially bullied by university administration. And I was just kind of wondering if your guests would comment on that.
Casey, I'm interested in the answer to your question, but I'm also interested in who the speaker was.
You know,
do you remember?
At the time, I knew exactly who it was, but unfortunately, of course, that could be a irrelevant part of the question, but it was a well-known speaker from Fox News, and I want to say, you know what, I can't remember who it was, but
okay.
it was a Fox News journalist. So it definitely wasn't a right-wing nut job, so to speak. I mean, it was someone who was conservative and nowhere near as far to the right as Michael Moore was, who has no political resume whatsoever and really had no right speaking to college students, in my opinion, when it comes to politics. But because he was a filmmaker who made a big splash prior to the 2004 election, he was considered relevant and was allowed to come to campus.
Okay.
And just recently, about 6 months ago, a student was reported being harassed by university administration in a university somewhere in the east, I can't remember where, because he was protesting Obamacare and he was stating facts about Obamacare, about how it really is disadvantageous to a lot of Americans.
Well, and,
he was stifled.
I hear you, and it raises an interesting point. Let me give Greg Lukianoff a chance to respond. Casey, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Sure. I never make any bones about it, and I'm very clear about it in the book. If you're going to get in trouble for an opinion, it's more likely that you're going to get in trouble for a socially conservative opinion. And I think that it's just an issue people can't wish away. And I've definitely, every year when it comes to convocation time, when they come to invite campus speakers, we sort of somewhat darkly refer to that within FIRE as disinvitation season. Huh. It's when the students or the administration get together to ask that they disinvite commencement speakers. And it is funny how often and how much it seems to, I talked about this to the New York Times, that there's been an uptick in students protesting that, and chances are the person's going to either be somewhat socially conservative or, for example, Ray Kelly at Brown, who was shouted down at Brown and not allowed to talk. It definitely is part of the ecosphere on campus that it's harder to say some opinions than others.
And is that because college campuses tend to lean liberal?
People tend to want to shut down opinions they disagree with and not as much with ones they agree with. So I'm sure that's part of it.
Do students on a college campus, do they have rights to an attorney if they're facing some kind of disciplinary charges?
Generally they don't, but several states have been passing, including North Carolina, just passed a right to attorney law. Virginia just floated one. So there's definitely a pushback against the fact that universities are taking on, including sexual assault, but also things as serious as, homicide in some cases. Mm. They're having campus tribunals about felonies. And there's been a little bit of pushback about that, saying, listen, if you're going to actually act like you're a proper criminal court, you should follow the procedures of a proper criminal court.
And anything you anticipate for 2014?
It's going to be a big year. We're hoping that, after every single defeat that university speech codes have seen, and they've been defeated every single time, we're hoping to make a push to make it clear to universities that the age of campus speech codes should come to a close.
Well, on that note, Greg Lukianoff, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's the president of FIRE, which stands for Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's an organization that's been around for a number of years now and actually headquartered here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our homepage at whyy.org/radiotimes, you can post a comment. You can also get information about podcasts, Twitter, and Facebook. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.